Welcome to this month's edition of Alternative Currents. I'm Bella Johnson. This month, we are privileged to be speaking with Frank Ostaseski, founder of the Zen Hospice Project in San Francisco. Zen Hospice Project operates a residential hospice in a beautiful Victorian home and a palliative care unit within the nation's largest long-term care facility. Volunteers from all walks of life are the heart of this caregiving program. A comprehensive training and their own spiritual practice prepare them to provide practical and emotional support at the bedside. Combining spiritual insight with social action, they form the core of a learning community focused on exploring the possibilities for transformation that are inherent within the experience of dying. This learning is shared across the country and in Europe throughout the year in a series of workshops, retreats, and caregiver trainings. This from the brochure included on the CD, Being a Compassionate Companion, or set of CDs, An Intimate Conversation with Frank Ostaseski. Zen Hospice and Frank are going to be represented at the Regency in Bar Harbor, June 17th and 18th of this year, put on by the Hospice of Hancock County. And for more information, you can call 888-266-8035 or go to the website www.alayainstitute.org. That's A-L-A-Y-A institute.org. I would imagine Hospice of Hancock at their site also has information on this workshop, www.hospiceofhancock.org. And with all those pieces of information provided, I'd like to welcome Frank to the show today.
Thanks, Bella. It's nice to be with you.
It's wonderful to have you here. Frank, having listened to this series of CDs this morning and been really deeply touched by listening to them, can you start maybe speaking to, you say we all know how to assist in the death process, how to be compassionate companions. How have we forgotten this?
Well, I think actually this is something that we know deep in our bones, that we've been caring for each other for hundreds and hundreds of years. But in the last several decades, I think we have so professionalized caregiving, made it such a technical event, that I think we've lost contact with a certain kind of basic generosity, spirit, that and a naturalness, I would say, that's part of the caregiving process. So I think workshops like the one we're doing in Hancock help remind us in a way of what we already know.
Right.
You know, we reach out to each other every day in hundreds of caring ways. And so it's the most natural thing that, you know, when someone is hurting, that we reach out to assist them. You know, when your left hand is hurting, your right hand immediately reaches over and comforts it. And I don't think it's so awfully different than being with people working with serious illness. We begin to recognize that their suffering is also our suffering. And so I always say that we're both in the soup together in this work.
Yes, I think it's one thing to reach out to friends who are in need and hurting, and it's another to reach out to someone in a dying process. It just seems somehow very different to me anyway, and I think to a lot of people it's almost frightening. It's like, what if we don't do the right thing, or you know, I think sometimes people just are very awkward when it comes to grief.
Yeah, sure. I think that's a natural and normal response given the kind of bias that exists in the culture to keep death at arm's length. I mean, just look at all the ways that we try to keep death at a distance. We have a multi-billion dollar cosmetics industry trying to keep us all looking young. We take our elders and we put them away in nursing homes so we won't have to bear witness to our own destiny and to their pain. By some accounts, we spend 50% of our healthcare dollars in the final 6 months of life literally throwing money at death. I mean, we even put rouge on people in the coffin. These are all ways that we try to keep death at arm's length. And so it's no wonder that we've become frightened. At the same time, though, I want to say it makes me really sad, actually, that this is occurring. What really makes me sad is that people are missing the opportunity to be with people near the end of their lives. That we're not always taking advantage of the possibilities of being with our even our loved ones. There's an extraordinary opportunity for transformation, for growth, that happens near the end of our life. And it's a time, really, of giving and exchanging love. These are the things that are most important there. And unfortunately, as a culture, we're missing this. We're standing back from this. And it makes me terribly sad that that's the case.
I wonder if some of our resistance to this is just the depth of our denial, in a sense, as to what we felt in a relationship with this person, if it's someone we've known well, even to the point of saying, well, you know, if they're dying, well, good, you know, good, the world would be better off without them. Or to the opposite extreme, there's so much to resolve with this person, I don't even know where to begin, so why initiate the process? It's too much to burden them with at the end of their life.
Well, you know, I'm not so sure that these situations that you've just described are so different at the end of one's life as they are at any other time in our life.
Right.
I think that it may be difficult to clear up difficulties in relationships, to give and extend, to give and receive forgiveness. These are hard to do at any point in our life. But certainly near the end of one's life, we don't get to do it over again. You know, we don't get a second chance here. And so I think it's really important that we use that time, that dying time, as a time to clarify, to give and exchange love, to find out what has meaning and value in our life. You know, I think that this time of being with someone who's dying is characterized by mutual benefit. It's not just about caring for the person who's dying. As a caregiver, I'm also looking at my own relationship to death. I'm studying my own experience of grief, examining my own fear. And so I'm also growing in this process. And I think sometimes we forget about that. We forget that there's an opportunity for the caregiver to grow as well.
Well, I think that's what you bring out in the material that you've presented in these wonderful CDs. Again, the CDs entitled Being a Compassionate Companion. They are produced by whom? How could one get hold of these? Do they need to go to your website in order to order them?
They can order them through the Zen Hospice website, www.zenhospice.org, and they'll find the either CDs or audio tapes there, and they can purchase them.
In these CDs, there's a real emphasis, of course, on the Zen tradition and kind of incorporating that as a part of this process in assisting someone in their death, but also healing or, in a sense, creating an opportunity for wholeness within the person who is doing that assisting. You talk about the difference between, let me see if I can find this here. Yes, the difference between helping and serving, and I really liked what you said about that.
Well, the work that we do has its foundations in this notion of service, service being something that we do with our whole beings. When we help, we incur debt. It's a relationship that's not characterized by equality. When I help, I use my strength, and so I begin to think of the other person as weak. So, when I serve, though, it's quite different. When I serve, I don't just use my strength. I use my whole being. I recognize that not just my strength and expertise serve, but also my weakness and my fear and my helplessness and my confusion. All of those serve, too. They serve as meeting places where I can support and meet the individual who might be dying. I think it's also true to recognize that service is different than fixing. A lot of times in healthcare, we set about trying to fix people. Now, I think we fix broken pipes. I don't think we fix people. When we set about trying to fix someone, we see them as broken. When we serve, we see them as intrinsically whole. So we could say that these are sort of fundamental ways of seeing the world. You know, when we help, we see the situation or the person as weak. When we fix, we see the situation or the person is broken. But when we serve, we see them as whole. So I think in the course of caring for someone who's ill or coming near the end of their life, it's very important to continually reflect the wholeness that's already there and to keep drawing, if you will, on that intrinsic wholeness that each of us have, just because we're human beings. You know, if we're not really careful, most of us are pretty wedded to the idea of being a helper. And if we're not really careful, this identity will imprison both us and the people we serve. You know, I sometimes say that helper's disease is more rampant in this country than AIDS and cancer put together. And what I mean by that are the ways that we try to distance ourselves from other people's suffering through our pity or our professional warmth. You know, this is very intimate work, caring for someone who's dying. You can't do it from a distance. So I think in order to do it well, we have to really bring our whole self to the experience and see the wholeness that's there in this other person, even if they, in this moment, appear to be in a rather distressing disguise.
Yeah, when you were talking about the death of your friend John, really touching story, and talking about when he said to you, you know, you're trying too hard, and you just kind of collapsed at that point, and really, what an opportunity to for healing for yourself in that place. Do you think that was your helper self at that point?
Yeah, I mean, the story, for the benefit of listeners, without going into the whole length of it, has to do with my caring for a very dear friend with AIDS, who in one day lost his ability to speak or hold a fork or stand or speak in any intelligent way. And it really scared me, you know, Bella? It just scared me. I mean, my friend was there just a moment ago, and now he was gone, or so it seemed. And so, yeah, I set about, you know, treating him like he was an infant. I'm embarrassed to say that now, but that's actually how I treated him. Until at one juncture, he reaches out to me out of his confused mind and says, "Frank, you're trying too hard." And there I stopped. And I remember just sitting beside the toilet and crying. But that moment, sitting there beside the toilet, was the most intimate of our whole relationship. Because right then, there was no separation between us. I was finally willing to enter the territory of helplessness, which he was already living in. Now, we didn't stay helpless forever. We figured out what to do after that. But we really couldn't figure out what to do until we were willing to enter into that territory. So what I was doing in that situation, I think, was trying to maintain some sense of safety and, you know, self-identity. Familiarity. Trying to be Mr. Hospice.
Familiarity, too, yeah.
Sure. Mm-hmm. When we, you know, are willing to step out from behind our well-protected roles or beliefs, identities, then I think we can be of real service to one another.
Right. Right. I want to remind listeners, we are speaking today with Frank Ostaseski, founder of the Zen Hospice Project, located in San Francisco, California. Frank will be conducting a workshop put on by the hospice, or certainly facilitated by the Hospice of Hancock County, at the Regency in Bar Harbor, June 17th and 18th, entitled Being a Compassionate Companion. For more information, numbers 888-266-8035, or go to the website www.alayainstitute.org, A-L-A-Y-A, institute.org, or I would imagine hospiceofhancock.org also has that information for you. Frank, you speak about five precepts on the journey of becoming a compassionate companion for a dying person. Can you speak about those a little bit?
Yeah, well, first I would say that, in my view anyway, a basic awareness of death is missing here in our culture. And that when we are willing to turn a little bit toward this experience, and this is a reflection that every spiritual tradition through time has offered us, and, you know, literature has offered us. Carlos Castaneda wrote about keeping death on our right shoulder, right, for so many of us remember reading those books. Mm. I think an awareness of death really offers us a clear mirror in which to see our daily choices. It shows us what has meaning and value, what's really important in our life. And so I think it lends a certain kind of power and grace, fullness, we could say, to our lives. A life that doesn't include death is only half a life. And so when we remove ourselves or remove death, remove ourselves from the reflection on this, or remove death from our culture, we have this feeling as though we're something's not quite right, I would say. So although there's a lot of encouragement to deny death and keep it at arm's length, I think what I'm trying to suggest is that there's a tremendous healing by welcoming it into our life. Let me say one or two more things about that. Oftentimes, when we are willing to see the precariousness of this life, just how absolutely fragile it can be at times, we begin to understand also just how precious it is. And then we don't want to waste a moment. Then we want to jump into our life with both feet. And so the reflection on death, strangely but true, causes us to step much more fully into our lives. Now, regarding these five precepts that you just mentioned, a little while ago we developed some very basic guides to help people in caring for loved ones and others who might be facing life-threatening illness. I think of these as precepts, and my sense is that they're things that we need to live into in order to really fully understand it. We can't just take them as slogans or try to understand them just intellectually. And so when we actually embody them, I think they're valuable to us not only in being with dying, but perhaps also in other dimensions of our life. Would it be helpful if I name those now?
Oh, sure.
Well, the first is, welcome everything, push away nothing. Welcome everything, push away nothing. Now, this sounds great. Would make a great bumper sticker. But how do we do it? I think what this precept is asking of us is for a kind of fearless receptivity. Fearless doesn't mean we're not afraid. It means that there is fear occurring and we are not entirely identified with it. We understand that there's more to us than the fear. So this kind of fearless receptivity is willing to meet whatever's presenting itself. Now, this doesn't mean we have to like everything that comes. It just means we have to be willing to meet it. Actually, I'm going to pause here just for a second. I know I'm sorry to do this in the middle of your cut, but
it's okay.